Our second case is the unemployment cop. There was actually a third case calendared here that got settled, so we're prepared to proceed with Taylor. Both of you had an opportunity to review our written statement of oral argument procedures, and do you have any questions?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes.
Ready to hear argument?
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Peter Witteveld on behalf of the appellant, Unika Taylor. Unika Taylor is appealing a decision from the Industrial Claim Appeals Office denying her unemployment benefits. This decision denied her unemployment benefits despite the fact that her employer, DPS School District, did not present evidence in support of their fraud allegation against Ms. Taylor. The employer did present evidence in support of this fraud allegation that should not have been admissible at the hearing officer level, was not reversed at the ICAO, and this is why we're here today. Ms. Taylor deserves a chance to present evidence that would show that she did not truly commit this allegation against her. She deserves a chance to rebut evidence that is put against her. She was not given this opportunity at her hearing officer decision level. The evidence that was...
And that's because of the hearsay?
Yes, it's because of the hearsay and because of the allowance of the hearing officer to allow the employer's investigator to testify as to the veracity of their main witness.
Let me ask you, Mr. Witteveld, if I can. Let's assume, for purposes of my question only, that you're totally right on this point. The investigator should not have opined on Ms. Fields' veracity, and that you're also right that Ms. Fields' hearsay statements should not have been admitted. Ms. Fields is gone from this case. Isn't there enough evidence to sustain the decision here without any of that?
It is true that there are other allegations besides those that are based on just Ms. Fields' testimony, but those allegations standing by themselves aren't enough to justify a decision to dismiss her or to deny her unemployment benefits. Without the fraud allegation, which is Ms. Fields' testimony goes towards, we don't know what the hearing officer or the ICAO would have decided. If you're to remove Ms. Fields' testimony completely from the picture, this, in our opinion, takes away the whole fraud issue as well.
Wouldn't you still have evidence that she drafted these letters that she wasn't authorized to draft? And then at least there was one letter in the computer, I think this was separate from Ms. Fields' testimony, where she made up a fictitious name, and in the letter she had incorrect information. Why isn't that enough?
I can address all three allegations separately. The first letter in the computer she never printed or submitted to anybody else. It was never given to her employer. It was never given to any other employee. The letter with the, your first point was about the authorization to submit the letters. Ms. Taylor testified that she didn't know she did not have authorization to submit those letters.
But there was a secretarial supervisor who testified to the contrary.
There's a secretarial supervisor who did not testify as to She testified that Ms. Taylor didn't have that authority, but Ms. Taylor testified herself that she didn't know. And the requirement is that the person, the employee who's being fired, must know herself. It's a volitional standard. She must have actual knowledge of that workplace rule to be able, in order to violate it. She made an honest mistake. In the end, she didn't have that authority, but she testified, and her testimony wasn't contradicted except through hearsay, that she thought she had that authority.
Wasn't there testimony? Ordinary
court. It addressed authority, but not specifically the employment letters. The annual training ceremony that you're referring to didn't apprise Ms. Taylor specifically of her authority to write these specific letters that are in dispute. It's more of a constructive notice in that sense. So she didn't know specifically about these letters that we're talking about today.
So I may have misunderstood this claim, so give me a second here. I was under the impression that your client was disqualified for failure to meet established job performance or other defined standards. Is that correct?
Yes.
Your view is that she needed to have subjective appreciation of these standards in order for them to be established or defined within the meaning of the statute?
Well, I believe that she was fired, and that's like a general overview of the standard, but specifically the standards were violating a workplace rule, specifically, as the other judges referred to, the workplace rule of having the authority to write these employment letters. And I believe the standard of PAPST, the PAPST case has been cited, is that she needed to have actual knowledge of this workplace rule, and that she needed to volitionally violate this workplace rule with the actual intent of violating a workplace rule. So that is that was my interpretation of the standard, at least.
Thank you.
Absolutely. She had been
I would say that the only inference that can be drawn is from, as I said earlier, the hearsay statements of the DPS investigator. If Ms. Fields testified, Ms. Fields is the woman whose name Ms. Taylor thought she had permission to sign. If Ms. Fields testified, then there would have been inferences to that point.
You're saying the secretarial supervisor's testimony does not permit a reasonable inference, even if other inference she had knowledge?
Not in our view. With Ms. Taylor's direct testimony that she said she didn't have the knowledge, there must be shown that the standard is higher than just having the secretarial supervisor testify that there might have been a reasonable inference. I think the standard's higher than that, the volitional acts.
Why?
Why? Under PAPS, there has to be an intention to violate the workplace rule and an actual knowledge that she was aware of this rule. It can't be inferred from circumstances. If Ms. Taylor testified that she knew this workplace rule, then yes, that would have satisfied it.
May I ask you, Mr. Whittefeld, on PAPS, the court in PAPS, or the division in PAPS, said was that under this section, all that's required is claimant did not do the job for which he was hired and which he knew was expected of him. You just start talking about intent. PAPS doesn't talk about intent. I grant you, it says which he knew was expected of him, and I was going to ask your friend across the aisle there about this. I guess I'm having trouble seeing where that comes from in the statute.
Right, and under PAPS, that language that you quote is what I relied on, knew was expected. I want to differentiate between an act violating a workplace rule and actual knowledge of the workplace rule. If an employee knows of a workplace rule and unintentionally violates it, or that's almost more like a negligence standard. And I'm not arguing that an employee shouldn't be, that the employee would be fired for that justly. What I'm arguing is that the employee didn't know the actual rule itself. And that is a higher standard than actually violating a rule that you know. So there's a difference between knowing the workplace rule and negligently violating one that you do know.
I just want to make sure I understood. Sure. You're saying your position is she did not even know that she was not authorized to do this.
Correct.
All right. And then maybe you've responded to this already in response to Judge Webb's question. But why can't we infer from the supervisor's testimony that there was training about what she was and was not authorized to do? Why can we not infer from that, or a reasonable fact finder can infer from that she knew?
It could infer from that, but the direct testimony of Taylor, in my opinion, should override that. Ms. Taylor herself testified that she didn't know. You can infer from the testimony of a supervisor, but the standard is higher than just an inference. It needs to be shown that she actually knew, an actual knowledge standard. And to go to that point as well, the workplace training didn't specifically address these letters. Ms. Fields was concerned about writing these letters, but that's why she went to Ms. Fields and asked for her permission. And according to Ms. Taylor, she had the permission from Ms. Fields to write the letters.
She had permission to sign her name, according to Ms. Taylor, not to write the letters.
That was a misstatement, I apologize.
Okay. And I just want to make, I'm sorry to beat a dead horse here if I am, I apologize to you. The inference, you're saying that if you can infer from the secretarial supervisor's testimony, let's assume you can infer that she was not authorized to write letters, you're saying that will not carry the day in the face of Ms. Taylor's testimony that she didn't know. The inference gets outweighed by the actual testimony.
The inference gets outweighed by the actual testimony, in addition to that there's no other evidence put into the record, at least, that says Ms. Taylor knew about the workplace rule. That's the only testimony there was, and there was no other direct evidence in addition to the secretarial supervisor's testimony. That inference, the implied inference of the lack of evidence in addition to Ms. Taylor's testimony, outweighs the day. Is how I would argue. Under Liggett, there's a strong public policy that the veracity of another witness should not be commented on by a witness present at a hearing. Ms. Fields' testimony was never procured on the day of the hearing. Ms. Taylor never had a chance to cross-examine Ms. Fields about what truly happened. In a right such as unemployment benefits, which Ms. Taylor truly needed, she had the right to cross-examine Ms. Fields. She was the most vital witness that was there. Her, along with David Cola, who was also present, had vital testimony, and yet the employer, who had access to David Cola, investigated him. They asked him questions, yet they never asked him whether Ms. Fields consented to using her name on the paper. In addition, the employer also had evidence, a video in the form of a video, which tape recorded the incident in question. The employer never produced this at the hearing, although the hearing officer wasn't required to make a negative inference from this, he was required to at least consider it in showing that the employer had this evidence, yet they didn't introduce it. In fact, this tape was nowhere to be found in the hearing.
In the proceedings before the hearing officer, did Ms. Taylor ask that a negative inference be drawn by the hearing officer from the absence of the videotape?
Yes, counsel requested that or asked that a negative inference be drawn. And the hearing officer declined to make any type of inference from this videotape not being submitted.
Counsel, am I correct in my understanding that the tape is just a videotape and there is no audio?
Yes. The videotape, to my understanding from Ms. Taylor, is that Ms. Taylor walked over to Ms. Fields' desk, which was in close proximity to her own, asked her if she could put her name, and Ms. Fields did a nodding gesture. Now, I'm not testifying or telling you today that that's actually what it said, but that, according to Ms. Taylor, is what the video contained. There is no audio.
I'm sorry, Mr. Whitefeld, I didn't mean to interrupt you. How would that be relevant, though? I mean, the fact is she could have not, we could speculate. She said, it's a nice day, isn't it? And she nodded. And without any audio, just all we're going to do is see one woman talking to another and perhaps nodding or grimacing or anything else. How is that possibly relevant?
Well, it's my understanding that Ms. Taylor had the letter in her hand as well, and she walked over to her desk, and there's at least an inference that that was what was the conversation was. Whether that's truly what happened, as you said, they could be talking about anything. It's at least entitled to an inference of what happened.
It did. I understand your client asked for the negative inference. Did she make an offer of proof or make that argument that you just made what this would show?
No, she made the negative inference argument only.
Didn't present to the court what the hearing officer what this might show.
Right. Ms. Taylor did argue that presumably it would show that. I apologize if I could backtrack. If my recollection of the record is right, she did argue that it would show Ms. Taylor's going over to going over to Ms. Fields' desk, which is in close proximity to her own, with the letter in hand. Under Liggett, there's a strong public policy advanced by the Colorado Supreme Court that the veracity of another witness shouldn't be advanced by another. Additionally, under Flowerstop, although this is an administrative proceeding and hearsay is admissible under Flowerstop, the hearsay in this case is highly prejudicial to Ms. Taylor. In addition, Ms. Taylor's own testimony clearly contradicted the hearsay that was introduced. These two factors alone, as well as the factor that Ms. Fields was never available for cross-examination, lead to the conclusion that this hearsay shouldn't have been admissible, even though it was an administrative proceeding. Under flower stop tests, it doesn't meet these requirements. In addition, Ms. Taylor said nothing to gain from this alleged fraud. The fraud violation was why she was dismissed. The fraud violation was primarily the reason she was dismissed and primarily the reason the hearing officer relied on to deny her unemployment benefits. Ms. Taylor stood to gain nothing personally from allegedly committing fraud. Her own testimony contradicted these fraud allegations, and the only evidence that the employer put on was through this hearsay. They didn't meet their burden of proof to show the fraud elements. For these reasons, the appellant, Unika Taylor, respectfully requests that the decision of the hearing officer be remanded, be reversed to the hearing officer, and a new hearing be issued without this hearsay testimony, without the testimony of the district's investigator, applying to the veracity of another witness. Thank you. If I could just reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Give me 1 second.
Rebuttal for the other side's argument. Okay. What's that? Oh, okay. 20 seconds, is that right? No. Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Katie Allison, attorney registration number 39430, appearing on behalf of the Industrial Claim Appeals Office. I want to take a step back and look at the big picture here, which is that we're dealing with a question of whether the claimant was at fault for her termination, such that she's disqualified from receiving unemployment benefits. This is not a fraud case. And what I think you will find is that each one of the many falsifications and misstatements that the claimant made in these letters supports a disqualification from benefits. And I think you sort of alluded to that, Judge Gabriel. I will first discuss the standard for determining fault in this case. Then I will discuss the many misstatements and falsifications the claimant made in creating these employment verification letters and why each one of them supports disqualification. Briefly, the falsifications are as follows. The claimant wrote employment verification letters without authorization. She forged a coworker's signature. She listed a false title for the coworker. She copied a different school's letterhead and put it onto one of the letters. She made up a false person to sign one of the letters. And she wrote incorrect dates on the letters.
Does your recitation of that evidence distinguish between the letters that were actually proven to have been sent versus the letters that were found on her computer, which may have been drafts?
No.
If you don't distinguish, why don't you give me the list again as limited to letters that were proven to have been sent?
Okay. Of the letters that were proven to have been sent, she didn't have authorization to write them. There were 5 total letters. She didn't have authorization to write any of them. She forged a coworker's signature. She listed a false title for the coworker, and she wrote incorrect dates. I want to briefly mention that the one letter that was just found on her computer, she stated in testimony that she did intend to use that letter. A person is at fault for her termination if she failed to meet job performance standards. This is a catch-all provision, and it is broad, and it is easy to meet. An individual is properly disqualified under this section if she knew what was expected and failed to comply.
Can I ask you on that, Ms. Allison, if you had addressed, and my principal concern with your side of this case, is the court found knew or should have known.
Right.
I'm sure you would wish that should have known wasn't there, but it sounds like you concede that you had a sticking with Pabst. What do we make of the should have known language, and isn't that problematic?
That's a good question. And
thanks.
I have to also note the hearing officer also said that she volitionally created the documents without authority. So where he in one part said knew or should have known, I think he later said she knew. But aside from that, I want to also look at the Richards versus Winter Park case. And this was a case where it was a lift operator who had daily safety checks to perform on his lift. And one day he forgot to perform one of them. He was fired for not doing his job properly. And the court found that even though his failure to comply was accidental or unintentional, he was still disqualified from receiving benefits because he failed to meet a job performance standard. So I think the standard goes a little further than PAPS and says that it can be even an unintentional mistake and you can still be disqualified under this provision. And I think this Winter Park case shows that this catch-all provision is broad, and a mere unintentional failure to comply is all it takes.
As I understand your observation there, that would go to the act or the failure to act. Your colleague's argument really goes to what does the employee know about the workplace rule? And you are conceding, I take it, that the employee has to have subjective knowledge of the workplace rule. It's not merely enough that the employee should have known of the workplace rule.
I'll concede that that's what the case law says. I think it's sort of questionable as to, you know, an employee, any employee could say, oh, I didn't know that that rule was there. The Winter Park lift operator could say, oh, I didn't know I had to perform that check, even though he performed it every day up until that time, and he obviously knew. And I don't think that should be a scapegoat necessarily. So I think that should have known is, I'm not sure that that should just be totally discredited.
Jump back to the letters for a minute, and I may have interrupted you. You were giving me a list of the problems, one of which was she created a phony letterhead or a letterhead for a different school. Does that apply to the letter that was sent or the one that was still sitting in her computer?
The phony letterhead was the letter that was still in her computer.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood the facts, and I thought the one in the computer had the fictitious name, but then she put Ms. Field's name on with the phony letterhead and sent that one. Maybe I have the facts jumbled up myself, and I apologize.
That's okay. Actually, let me look at it. I have the letters here. I believe, yeah, the one with the fictitious name is also the one with the phony letterhead.
Okay, thank you.
That's also the one that was never sent.
And that's the one that was never sent.
Thank you.
The one with Ms. Field's name on it does not have the fictitious letterhead.
That was sent.
And that was given to somebody, yes.
And the letter, was the letter or letters with the bad information, incorrect employment date, sent or not sent?
All of the letters had incorrect dates, so four of them were sent. I want to briefly note that the claimant in this, in her position, was in a position of trust. She handled confidential information, so part of her job standards were to be trustworthy enough to handle this information. And now I'll get into the employment letters. First, the claimant wrote employment verification letters without authorization. She argues that she didn't know she had the authority to write these, that she did not have the authority to write the letters because it was never listed in her job description. But this is a little bit unreasonable in that she's essentially saying that a job description should list everything a person cannot do. This would create some very long job descriptions. There was also testimony that she was indeed aware of this process, just as you noted, Judge Webb. It was written in the PowerPoint presentations that she received in her yearly meetings, and she had access to these presentations. And there was testimony that the claimant had previously been asked, or she had previously asked if she can do an employment verification and was told no.
So the PowerPoint verification specifically said persons in her position or job title cannot do employment verifications?
It's not in evidence, I don't believe, but I believe what the testimony said is that it said what the process was for employment verifications, which was you need to go to an HR secretary or something like that. And so it didn't say you couldn't go to Ms. Taylor, but. So she had previously been told, no, this is somebody else's job. This is payroll's job. She knew she didn't have the authority, and the hearing officer found that she knew this. The hearing officer said...
Well, said knew or should have known. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Right. The hearing officer in one instance says knew or should have known, and I'll quote to you where he says that basically she volitionally did this without authority. He said, the employer felt the claimant could not be trusted after the claimant created documents without authority that contained misrepresentations and included a forged signature. The claimant did those things volitionally. The claimant also forged Ms. Field's signature. This is something the claimant knew she was not authorized to do, but she did it anyway. The claimant argues that Ms. Fields authorized the use of her signature, but the court only has to look at the reason we're here today to see that this is not the case. Ms. Fields, who was friends with the claimant, brought a concern to her supervisor that she was worried about the claimant's unauthorized use of her signature. That concern led to the claimant's discharge, which is why we're here.
That's all the hearsay, though, isn't it?
Right. As the claimant argues, that is all hearsay. But I think in this case, you can look, the hearing officer properly weighed the flower stop factors. He stated them in his decision. And he made a specific finding that this hearsay evidence was admissible in administrative proceedings. And his findings on such matters are given great weight and should not be disturbed. The claimant also brought up the video. As was noted, this video had no sound. These desks were directly across from each other. And there was testimony that the claimant and Ms. Fields talked all day long. And it would be impossible to tell what they were talking about. Again, it was the hearing officer's decision as to whether this evidence was necessary. And he's found that it wasn't, and that is should not be disturbed.
Do you agree with your under this spoliation of?
From what I remember from the transcript, that there was just an objection, not an objection, but a request saying this videotape should not have been destroyed. And I don't think that it was ever brought up as to what exactly this videotape would have shown.
Likewise, you recall request for an
no specific request. No. In any case, the hearing officer specifically stated that the claimant forged Ms. Field's signature. This is a factual finding, and it is supported by the evidence. It is supported by Ms. Field's written statement that she did not authorize the use of the signature. It is supported by the principal's statement. It is supported by Ms. Field's supervisor statement. And again, it is supported by the reason this case is before you today. Again, forging someone's signature on a document that is written on behalf of the employer does not comply with job standards. The third falsification I want to discuss is the claimant's listing of a false title for Ms. Fields. This one is perhaps the most telling. It reveals not only the claimant's willingness to falsify those letters, it also shows the degree to which the claimant was aware of what she was doing. Ms. Fields was a secretary too, but the claimant listed Ms. Fields' title as HR secretary. The claimant knew Ms. Fields did not work in the HR department. She admitted she knew this. And the claimant worked with Ms. Fields on a daily basis, as we've discussed. Nonetheless, the claimant gave Ms. Fields a false title.
In your view, this act supports an inference that the claimant did know that employment verifications had to come from the HR.
Right, and that was what I was about to say is employment verifications do come from the HR department, and they do not come from Secretary Twos. And I think just the very, I mean, why else would she have written a false title for Ms. Fields? She knew exactly what Ms. Fields' title was. I don't really see any other reason why she would have written that she was an HR secretary. And when asked why she did this, the claimant said, no reason. She had no explanation, but I think the explanation is quite clear. She was already falsifying letters, and she might as well make them appear to be written by someone who had the authority to write them.
Did she put any, on the ones where she signed her own name, did she put any title on it? Do you remember?
Let me check. She wrote secretary.
I apologize. This is the third time I've asked you, and there's a failing memory. Is the letter that gave Ms. Fields the phony title one that was actually sent?
Yes.
Thank you.
Ms. Allison, if picking up on Judge Russell's question, let's assume we can, for purposes of my question, that we can infer from the fact she wrote HR that she knew she wasn't authorized. In your view, is that sufficient to overcome any problem of the hearing officer finding knew or should have known? In other words, can we say there's sufficient evidence in the record that she knew and affirm on that ground?
I think you absolutely could. And I also think that the knew or should have known went more to whether or not the claimant had the authority to write the letters. And the fact, the very fact that the claimant put a false title on this letter shows that she was falsifying a letter. She knew, I mean, I guess you could argue she didn't know she couldn't put a false title or sign a false name on a letter, but that's something that, that's one of those where she should have known it, and that seems like it would be sufficient. And again, I think any one of these sort of misstatements in the letters could are grounds for a disqualification. I see that my time is running low, and so I would just like to conclude by saying each one of the falsifications of the letters is sufficient to support a disqualification. The letters contain so many misrepresentations, so many fabrications, so much deception that the claimant could no longer be trusted to handle the confidential information that she needed to handle. She was clearly at fault for her separation and for the reasons stated in my answer brief and argued here today. I respectfully request that you affirm the panel's ruling.
You may have lost your remaining seconds because we were arguing about whether you had 2 minutes left or 20 seconds.
I think so. I only need 20 seconds anyway.
Take a minute, please.
Okay. First, I'd like to clarify one point for the record. I think Judge Gabriel asked me and you asked Ms. Allison. Ms. Allison's correct that no specific request for the inference for the videotape was ever made by Taylor. When reviewing the record, that is correct, Ms. Allison's assertion. There was no closing argument at the hearing officer level, so that's the reason for. Besides that, the newer should have known standard was found by the hearing officer. Under PAPST, as Ms. Allison stated, the employee unintentionally violated a workplace rule, but it did find in that case that the employee knew this rule. The employee knew this standard, and that is a standard that should have been applied by the hearing officer. The hearing officer should have found that Ms. Taylor knew the rule, not knew or should have known. And so the incorrect standard was applied by the hearing officer.
Thank you. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course. Council are excused. That exhausts our afternoon docket, and the bailiff may announce a recess.
Court will be in recess, subject to call.